Hey, all you wonderful Feminist Frequency listeners, it's me, Carolyn. As you may know, we're currently in the midst of our spring fundraising campaign running all through the month of May. We've just passed week 2 of that campaign, and with that, we have officially surpassed our first micro goal of $10,000. Thank you so much for getting us past that point to all of you who have donated. As a reward to everyone for helping us reach our first benchmark, I will be regaling you with more wonderful dramatic readings from Ready Player One. So stay tuned for that. It's going to be both, you know, horrifying and fantastic at the same time. You won't want to miss it. So with about 2 weeks left, we still have a ways to go to hit our ultimate goal of $35,000. But before we get there, we do have some more micro goals along the way, and you better believe there are some really fun rewards attached to those. So please, let's keep this momentum going. Give what you can at feministfrequency.com/donate. Share our campaign with all of your friends. We could really use your support. Thank you so much for being part of the Feminist Frequency family.
I have surpassed basic human notions of feeling good, feeling bad. I am existing now in a plane, Carolyn, that is pure mind.
Ah, yes. Hello, everybody, and welcome to Feminist Frequency Radio. This is episode 26. Anita's in Sweden, and I'm in the captain's chair this week. And I am joined, of course, by the co-host who refused to be beaten down by the flu last week, Ebony Astor. Hey, Ebony.
Hey. I am hanging on.
Thank you. We appreciate it. This is the show that asks you to be critical of the media you love, or alternatively, we're the feminist killjoys coming for your medias, depending on your perspective. In today's show, we're going to be talking about something old and something new, reflecting Ebony and I's passions. First, my love of classic cinema leads us to look at the incredibly sharp 1940 classic comedy of remarriage, His Girl Friday, starring Cary Grant and Rosalind Russell. Then, Ebony's love of crime fiction leads us to check out the new crime series Tennyson, a prequel to the fantastic BBC crime series Prime Suspect. As always, we'll both finish the show by sharing a little something in What's Your Freakout? Exclusively for our fantastic drip backers, this week's bonus is a conversation between Anita and our producer, Phil. It's a real treat. What is Drip, you ask? Well, let me tell you, it is a subscription-based membership platform, and your generous support is what helps us keep making this podcast. If you want to access special perks and exclusive backer rewards, join our podcast community at d.rip/femfreak. Now, on with the show. So, Ebony, you really did power through for us last week. Are you feeling any better this week? How you doing?
I am 13% closer to life than I was to death.
Okay.
Am I feeling better?
Okay.
I have surpassed basic human notions of feeling good, feeling bad. I am existing now in a plane, Carolyn, that is pure mind.
Yes.
It takes gallons of cheap cough medicine to get to this place, but I have achieved it.
Wow.
Yeah. And so I guarantee you the amount of sense that I make on a normal podcast is what? Probably about a smooth 43%. That's not at all what I'm going to achieve in today's podcast.
Okay.
I'm really excited to hear what I'm going to say.
Yeah. We all are. So let's hop into a little bit of pop culture news for the week. You know, first of all, let's talk about the Me Too movement because, you know, I think a lot of us, our feelings on the Me Too movement have been, you know, okay, sure. We get it. But what does Roman Polanski think about all this?
I have been dying to know.
Yeah, and he, you know, this past week answered that question. He said, I think this is the kind of mass hysteria that occurs in society from time to time. Sometimes it's very dramatic, like the French Revolution or the St. Bartholomew's Day massacre in France. Or sometimes it's less bloody, like 1968 in Poland or McCarthyism in the U.S., Everyone is trying to back this movement mainly out of fear. I think it's total hypocrisy. So, Wow. Yeah, totally reasonable, you know, points of comparison there. To those often extremely grim and bloody historical events that he mentioned.
McCarthyism.
Yeah, right? McCarthyism, you know? Yeah.
So equating the Me Too movement to to people being, unjustifiably called out by their government and, you know, their respective industries for things, you know, that they were not guilty of. I gotta say, like, this is the hottest of hot takes, but the fact that it was Roman Polanski that delivered it, like, this would have been horrible had it come out of anyone's mouth. But the fact that it came from that dude.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, I'm trying to think of a way in which it could have been worse.
Yeah, yeah. I love the McCarthyism comparison. Like, I picture, you know, a panel of senators, you know, asking, like, in whose homes were some of these conversations about, you know, oppressing women held? In whose homes, you know? and then people being blacklisted.
I love this because there's this, you know, if there's hysteria that's been, you know, raked up by the Me Too movement, it is the hysteria that these poor, powerful, incredibly wealthy men might actually have to deal with the censure of the public for, I don't know, 3 days, a week, maybe a couple of months before they can go back to doing exactly what they were doing before. And so, you know, you have these comeback tours, like the Me Too movement, such as it is in the way that, like, it's been talked about in, you know, mainstream pop culture, right, has barely kind of taken a foothold in our cultural conversation. And yet already we're talking about comebacks. Comebacks!
Yeah.
Like, haven't been away long enough to have a fucking comeback. Go the fuck away.
And where are the comebacks for all the women whose careers were destroyed by these men?
They can't come back because they weren't allowed to come in the first place.
Yeah.
Fuck Roman Polanski.
Yeah. Yeah.
Fuck anybody who puts a mic in front of that dude's face or who lets him happy slap a keyboard and shares opinions with the world. Y'all can miss me with that shit. I couldn't believe it. Like, Roman Polanski, how do you even have the gall to open your mouth? Just whatever.
All right. Well, in more upbeat news, you know, with the cancellation of Brooklyn Nine-Nine by Fox last week, led to just an outpouring of sadness and campaigning for the show to be picked up. You know, my Twitter feed was pretty much just top to bottom calls for the resumption, I guess, of Brooklyn Nine-Nine. And NBC, you know, seeing this tremendous outpouring of support and adoration for the show, stepped in and said, you know, we can make some money on this show, even if Fox can't, we'll give it a shot. So, and I do think that it does seem to make more sense. It seems to be a better fit in the sort of NBC sort of style of comedy, you know, where you have these kind of smart, dialogue heavy, snappy comedies going back to like 30 Rock. I know you're not a fan of Tina Fey, but it's definitely in that mold of like witty repartee and stuff like that, as opposed to kind of the more traditional old school sitcom jokes that you get on stuff like, you know, the CBS range of shows, Big Bang Theory or Two and a Half Men, or, you know, things like that. So hopefully it'll find a good home there at NBC.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, NBC already has The Good Place, which is a show we all love, you know, and is another Michael Schur show. So I wonder if some of the audience for that The Good Place has achieved will, you know, maybe there can be some cross promotion, you know, with the two Michael Schur shows.
Right.
And Brooklyn Nine-Nine can start to get. You know, Brooklyn Nine, it's a show that I've watched occasional episodes but haven't really dipped into. You want to talk hypocrisy, Roman Polanski? Here's hypocrisy. I watch so many grim, dark cop shows, but for some reason, Brooklyn Nine-Nine, I got on my high horse about it. You know, people call it, like, copaganda, right? And I'm just like, I had the nerve to be like, I don't know if I should be watching this show, given the shit that I've said about the police in the past.
Yeah.
And about, like, policing as an institution. Oh my God. The amount of mental gymnastics I have to do just to watch TV on a Sunday night, Caro, it's exhausting.
All right. With that, we're going to move on into the main segments of the show. You know, with Anita away, Ebony and I decided to take advantage of this opportunity to kind of focus on things that are...
Do what we want. Now that mom's away?
Yeah, exactly. To focus on things that, you know, are particularly of interest to us, but maybe don't always fit into, like, what the sort of really current, you know, covering the big stuff that's happening right now that we often strive for and will continue to strive for on Feminist Frequency Radio. So I wanted us to talk about a 1940 comedy classic called His Girl Friday. And before we even start talking about the film itself, I want to talk a little bit about the type of film it is and the period in which it was made. So it was made during a period when the production code or the Hays Code was still in effect in Hollywood. And this put all kinds of limitations on what the subject matter or content of a film could be, you know, for, like, quote unquote, moral reasons. Right. And so any depiction of, like, adultery was forbidden. And so So His Girl Friday is an example of a genre called the comedy of remarriage, which is a film, a genre that really existed specifically to get around that provision in the Hays Code. So the comedy of remarriage, what it does is it has the two main characters, the two romantic leads, who you know are going to get together in the end. They either get divorced very early on in the film, or they've already divorced, but they are, you know, so they're exes when the movie begins. And so that enables them to flirt with others and, you know, without risking the wrath of censorship, and then get back together at the end. So this is it's also a film, you know, kind of in related to, like, the screwball comedy genre, and it so it has a lot of, like, I think the signifying quality to me of this film is a lot of, like, really rapid fire dialogue, sharp wits, and just, like, overlapping dialogue sometimes, so there's multiple characters talking and everything, and to me that makes for such a lively viewing experience. I guess I would say that the closest thing to it in, you know, modern writing would be maybe some of Aaron Sorkin's stuff, like The West Wing or something. But there's, because these are, like, romantic comedies, there's a different sort of edge to these films. And what, so what's really great, one of the things that's really great about His Girl Friday, which is not without its problems and issues that we'll get into, but is it's a story of romance between Cary Grant, who's plays the editor of this paper called The Morning Post, and his ex-wife named Hildy Johnson, who is, like, far and away the star, or was the star reporter on his paper, like, just, you know, outclassed every other reporter, you know, in, if you want a big story written up right, you want Hildy Johnson to write it up. And so when the film begins, she's engaged to this guy named Bruce Baldwin. He's an insurance salesman. He's kind of, you know, he's a lot like the Bill Pullman character of more, you know, like 90s romantic comedies, where he's, like, kind of sweet and, like, you don't exactly dislike him, but you also know that he's not, like, good enough for her. Like, he's not quite deserving of her, or not, just not right for her. And so he's that kind of character where it's like, yeah, sorry, bud. But what's really interesting to me about this film is, like, he's offering her he's offering her like a very traditional life, right? Come, let's get married. You can, we have kids and everything. And, you know, she can just settle down. And she thinks that's what she wants, but actually it's not, you know, what she wants. I mean, being a journalist, the newspaper business is in her blood. And so what's so interesting about this film is, to me, one of the things that's interesting about the gender politics of this 1940s film is that it doesn't end with the woman realizing that, oh, she should settle down and, like, have babies and be, like, a traditional woman. It ends with her kind of realizing, oh, she does belong in the newspaper business, right? She needs to continue being that, like, career woman, right. Albeit one who's, like, married to the head of the paper, but, you know, he does not want to, like, limit her prospects or, like, put her in a kind of gilded cage, right? He wants her to be a newspaper. There's a great line in the film where the Cary Grant character says, like, you know, you can't get out of this business. You're a newspaper man. Like, it's in her blood. You're a newspaper man. Mm-hmm. And she says, you know, but I want to go somewhere where I can be a woman, right? Mm-hmm. But ultimately, she does decide to be a quote-unquote newspaper man.
Yeah, I love that this is, you know, again, for a film that comes out in 1940, you have a heterosexual couple in which the male figure does not love the female figure despite her talents and the
right.
ways in which she is better than him, but because of those things. Throughout the film, we have, you know, Cary Grant's character, Walter Burns, saying, like, no, I'm not half the writer you are. I need you to do this. And there's never a sense in which, you know, he's made to feel like he's great at his stuff, you know, being the publisher and editor of the paper. She's this amazing writer. He knows that. He wants, there's never an issue about that. You know, like, he doesn't feel emasculated in any way by that. And in fact, his, you know, adoration and critical appraisal of Hildy is echoed by the other press guys, the other newspaper men, right? Like, in the press room, when they read her interview with the condemned man, they're like,
yes,
you know, a Hildy Johnson piece the minute you dive in, you know, like, no one else could write this. It is, and one of the other things that I had not seen this movie before, and it's in its entirety. I had seen, you know, bits and pieces from it, and of course, you know, like, I've seen the Cary Grant gif of him, you know, shouting, like, get out, you know, many
times. Yeah, there's two famous gifs. The get out, like, if you see Cary Grant saying, get out, that's from this film. There's also a great gif, or a great moment in the film where Hildy is so, you know, Walter says something just so infuriating, mm-hmm. you know, Hildy, like, throws something at him, and Cary Grant, like, ducks under it, you know, and so you see that gif a lot, too. It's such a great moment in the film. He's like, oh, your throwing arm is, you're losing your throwing arm. You used to be able to pitch better than that, right? Anyways, just that really sharp response, and that like, almost battle of, you know, intellectual equals, right?
Right.
Which is, it's so great.
It is. And, you know, so this movie is, you know, a smooth 90 minutes long, right? And yet I guarantee you this script for this movie, because of the density of the dialogue, is probably, you know, the same length as a modern movie that's 2.5 hours, because it just doesn't stop, you know? Like, there's such a kinetic energy in this movie from the language, but also the movement. Everything is so perfectly staged in terms of timing. And you can really see the origins of this film. It started as a play, you know, and it actually has been filmed a couple of times, but it absolutely, you know, has that same sort of energy whereby you're watching a kind of tableau occur, you know, in front of you. And while there may be things going on in the foreground, there are kind of elaborate set pieces happening in the background that have to be perfectly timed, like a Rube Goldberg machine. And you can't turn away for a second.
Exactly. This film demands your kind of full attention, and really, I think the first time, because I've seen it twice now, and the second time I followed the plot a lot better, but the plot isn't really so important in this film in some ways. But a few pieces of little trivia about this film. So Howard Hawks, the director, said about the script, he said, "I noticed that when people talk, they talk over one another, especially people who talk fast or who are arguing or describing something. So we wrote the dialogue in a way that made the beginnings and ends of sentences unnecessary. They were there for overlapping." So much of the film takes place in this press room at this jail where this man is going to be hanged the next day. So you have all these phones on this table for all these different reporters to their different newspapers. And at least according to Wikipedia, it says to get the effect that the director, Howard Hawks, wanted, you know, because multi-track sound recording was not yet available at the time, Hawks had the sound mixer on the set turn the various overhead microphones on and off as required for the scene in real time, as many as 35 times. So a lot of like hands-on work, you know, going behind the scenes to make this stuff happen. But I want to talk a bit too about other aspects of the gender dynamics of this film, because you know, this film, we sort of, I think, have to accept as we enter this film that it takes place in a kind of, again, like heightened reality, because the lengths that Cary Grant's character goes to keep Hildy from like leaving town, they are like, if someone did them in real life, they would be so, so incredibly unacceptable.
Right, I mean, right.
And yet, as viewers of this film, because we can see him like scheming in real time and like thinking up ways to like to manipulate the situation in real time, and because we're inclined to root for him because he's so much more charismatic and because we know he's right for Hildy, we sort of we almost like we're inclined to like overlook how awful everything he does is and still like root for him, you know?
Yeah, I think, you know, the film does such an amazing job of like visually and obviously, you know, verbally establishing that Walter and Hildy belong together. So there's that great shot when they go to lunch near the beginning of the film, and Walter and Hildy both light cigarettes, and the ways in which they hold the cigarette and they hold their bodies mirror each other. And then you have, you know, the blonde, you know, Bruce Baldwin, you know, over to the side at the table, not smoking. He's the last person to order. He looks like he shouldn't be there. He's not part of the puzzle piece. You know, as you say, like, we're inclined to root for Walter, even though he's a dick. Like, he's an absolute dick to Bruce. He's so high-handed, you know, but because we're charmed by his assholeness.
Yeah, I mean, he has, like, a criminal lackey of his, like, plant counterfeit money on Bruce to get him arrested. Like, he does all kinds of, like, absolutely outrageous stuff. He tells lies about other reporters of his being, like, out on, you know, because they're supposedly having a baby that day, but they're not. You know, I mean, just all kinds of stuff, and yet we go along with it. One thing I also want to touch on real quickly. You know, the whole sort of, there's a whole plot element to this film about this man, Earl Williams, who is convicted. He's about to be hanged. And it's really just a kind of scaffolding on which to build the romance. It's not, like, so much important in and of itself. And yet, I feel like it's interesting that the idea is, so Earl Johnson, there's a lot of sympathy for him that, you know, that he killed a cop with a, you know, and there's a lot of sympathy that there should be this insanity defense for him. But when they talk about it at the beginning, like, well, then why is he still, you know, why are the mayor and the sheriff so inclined to have him hanged? And they say, well, the cop he shot was black, and the black vote is very important in this town. And I'm like, this is some, like, bizarro world where a criminal is going to get a worse punishment because the victim was black.
Like, I know.
I mean, are you kidding me?
I had such an interesting experience. So as I said, I had not seen this movie in its entirety before this. And so my knowledge of the film was purely about the kind of, you know, verbal sparring between these, you know, incredibly dynamic comedic actors, right? I had no idea that there was this incredibly dark backstory that brings up, like, you know, issues about the death penalty, you know, like coming out of, you know, America coming out of the Great Depression and, you know, the kind of economic insecurities, you know, that are attendant upon, you know, gender. Like, there's a bunch of really heavy stuff. So I did know that, you know, as they say in the film, to use the terminology of the film, Earl Williams kills a colored cop and the colored vote is so important. And
right,
I was hollering at the idea that, like, this white dude would have killed, you know, a black man and then would be facing, as you say, a harsher punishment. But then there are moments when the discussion about Earl Williams and his case are so incredibly progressive in a way that I was not expecting. So, for instance, like Hildy's, you know, op-ed interview about him, you know, like it's such a measured, thoughtful, you know, critical, you know, opinion that's expressed about the death penalty and about the inhumanity in evidence there, but I could never sink entirely into it because as a black person in the year of our Lord 2018 watching this movie, in the way that I can never fully take a deep breath watching classic films, you have a newspaper man later on, you know, telling a story about this colored woman and her having a pickaninny baby, you know, in the back of one of the police wagons. And I'm just like, there is a resentment I have as a black woman, as a person of color, watching classic films that I know I can never entirely relax because you never know when one of those moments is going to hit you, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, speaking of, like, crime and all that, smooth segue there, Caro. Let's move into... Let's move into talking about Tennyson. Why don't you kind of set us up here and tell us a little bit about what Tennyson is?
There was an iconic English show called Prime Suspect starring the luminous, although occasionally problematic in her interviews, Helen Mirren, that, you know, was written and conceived by a writer named Linda LaPlante. It is one of the smartest... most atmospheric shows, and was really, you know, kind of set the standard for what crime dramas can be.
Absolutely. I think I love everything about Prime Suspect. Mm-hmm. It's definitely in among my top, you know, on the short list of my favorite television shows of all time. But I think that, you know, in a way, similarly to, you know, The Wire, there's a way in which its cases are always used to explore... they're not just like whodunits. They are stories that explore matters of, you know, of like racism in the community or like the treatment of queer people, or, you know, they delve into these other issues, you know, in the society.
Yeah. And you know, via the character, this absolutely fascinating character of Jane Tennyson, who is one of the few women who has achieved any real rank in, you know, British policing. That the story is largely set, I'm going to say, in London, although isn't there a season that's in Manchester? Or do I have that reversed? But at any rate, it's very urban. It's very gritty. It's not the kind of, like, you know, pastoral Midsummer Murders kind of crime show. This is absolutely about the ways that, like, the anonymity, the invisibility that can happen in a city, the vulnerability that living in, you know, a kind of grim urban area can confer, but also the ways in which communities spring up naturally and organically. One of my favorite moments is in the first season of Prime Suspect, when Tennyson is talking to a couple of prostitutes, and just the way in which, you know, it's conveyed that she has spoken happened to these women and women like them before many times. And the way these women look out for each other and that they have to look out for each other is really fantastic. And that's one of the things that I found really interesting about this show, Tennyson, which sets itself up as kind of a prequel series to Prime Suspect.
Yeah, I think the full title, just to place it in time, is Tennyson, Prime Suspect 1973.
So 18 years before the start of the first, the Prime Suspect that we know and love. And so we see the young Jane Tennyson, who is, you know, I think she's 22 years old, very young WPC, navigating this hyper-masculine, hyper-conservative, hyper-violent world that looks so different from the world we know now, and the world of the 90s that we were first introduced to in Prime Suspect, and yet is nevertheless incredibly familiar. One of the things that I found most interesting is I love shows that are set in the past, and the ways that we are given visual codes to show this is set in another time period. You know, the things that showrunners pay attention to and the things that they don't, you know? Yes, it's all about the clothing and the cars and the slang. And, you know, there'll be like occasional moments where you'll see like snack foods that were, you know, really hot in the 70s. But then there are other things that are never really discussed. So I don't know how many episodes you were able to get through. I watched two before this podcast.
Yeah.
So I don't know if we spend more time with any of the Black police men in this series, but at least in the two episodes that I saw, they are very much set dressing, specifically to show in some ways, like, wow, Jane's status is even lower than these Black officers in a way that kind of made me uncomfortable, right? Because there's a Black police officer who, like, leaves some dirty dishes in front of her and is like, hey, can you take care of this? And we're meant to think, like, oh, like, even this dude has more power than her. And
right.
I'm like, wait a minute. Wait a minute.
Yeah, I mean, he actually just puts the dishes there and says, ta, love. Right, and so, of course, there's an assumption among all the white, you know, police officers, they just come and they just assume, hey, oh, you know, a guy threw up in that room. Can one of you ladies go clean it up? Even though that's not like their job specifically, or just those kinds of things all the time. Those assumptions of what Jane and her, her female cohort there should be doing because they're women. And I was frustrated that, the Black officers, like, there's no even the slightest indication of any power, any racism against them or any power differential that they experience on the force.
Like, right. Which was done in Prime Suspect
exactly.
in the 90s, right?
That's what makes it so frustrating.
Exactly. And I was like, there's no way this wouldn't have been a bigger issue in 1973, which is not to say that Jane needed to necessarily try and find common cause, that naturally would have happened. But the fact that that was never mentioned, I just thought, you know, this rings so incredibly false to me. I thought there were things that were done very well, but that particular, I'm not surprised that Tennyson was not renewed for a second series. Apparently,
oh, is that right? It's already been canceled.
So okay. Apparently, Linda LaPlante had creative differences with ITV, and so as of right now, there is not going to be a second series.
That's interesting because I wonder what. Yeah, I wonder if what it would have been if she'd had more creative control. Because overall, I found the production of this series so much like slicker in a frustrating way than Prime Suspect. You know, Prime Suspect has that kind of just, you know, gritty on the ground with the police kind of, you know, authenticity to it. This series, it's full of like pop songs and slow motion shots and like these kinds of things that maybe some TV producers feel like they have to have in modern television to appease modern audiences, but that I feel in their kind of polished. I mean, I can get behind a great musical montage if that's part of the visual language
right.
of a show. Don't get me wrong. But in this particular show, because I wanted it to be very much in the spirit of its predecessor, that those elements all, they felt like they came between me and the reality that I was hoping for.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. There, one of the things that I did love about, well, love is a weird word to use for this, but Jane is asked to accompany one of the detectives to the pathologist's lab, and she goes, and this doctor, you know, essentially has her act out the assault upon the murdered girl, you know, to show this detective how it could have happened. And it is a moment of both very deliberate, but also unconscious on his part, humiliation of Jane as a young woman, and a way for her to be reduced to the level of the dead girl, right? So, you know, he has her get down on her knees and, you know, kind of accept his fake blows. And her utility in that moment is purely about the fact that she is a young woman herself of roughly similar size. And so she can be used to mirror this. And I thought of the few things that I did love about the show, I did love how that was done. You know, that there's very much a sense in the world in which she operates that, like, people cannot conceive of a reason for her to be there other than as a stand-in, you know, for the murdered girl, or for their mothers, or for, you know, their girlfriends or whatever. As a person herself, she simply does not exist.
Yeah, yeah. So another thing I found, you know, sort of interesting about the show is, so we see here Jane comes from like a rather posh background, right? And she's still living at home with her folks. Her sister is about to be married. Of course, the parents love her, the traditional like sister, and the mom is, you know, the mom is sort of like, why can't you be more like your sister? Why are you so into this police work? All these things. But and you know, Jane, there's a scene where Jane and her mother are arguing, and Jane is like swearing a lot and stuff, right? And the mother is like so ashamed and distraught, yes, about who her daughter has become. And at one point she says, you're effing and jeffing. And I'm like, what is this phrase? What does that even mean? I had to look it up, and it's like a Northern England slang term for swearing. So that was fun. I learned something, effing and jeffing. You know, you can all put that in your toolbox. If somebody's like swearing a lot, you can say, hey, what's with all the effing and jeffing?
you know what? Speaking of like kind of, you know, cultural markers like that were a little bit foreign, I loved that. I'm blanking on the dad's name now. The guy who's in prison, you know, at the beginning of the show, and then, you know, gets out, and he and his sons are going to carry out this bank heist. He's in a prison,
God, yeah,
where they have to wear like a jacket and tie. And I was hollering because I just thought, like, the final fucking indignity, you know, of like the panopticon of surveillance. Like, you can't even wear a t-shirt. You gotta wear a jacket and tie in this prison. Also,
in British prison, yeah.
I know, like, just so civilized, right? But that actor, Alan Armstrong, is the father of Joe Armstrong, who plays Ashley Cowgill in Happy Valley, which is an exponentially better show. And I hope one day you and I can talk about it, because I think, and talk about it in comparison to Prime Suspect, because I think this, the genre of hard-boiled, you know, female detective really reaches its apotheosis, and there's just such fabulous work being done in that show. So I hope one day to talk about it. Anyways, just a crime TV connection, Alan Armstrong to Joe Armstrong. If someone's putting this up on the big board, I expect at least 3 points for making that spot.
It is frustrating that I didn't get a sense yet in the two episodes that I watched that this show was going to use the murder case at its core to really delve into cultural issues in a meaningful way, right? Mm-hmm. It seemed to be more just a mystery, like just a straightforward kind of mystery. I mean, obviously, with, you know, some twists and turns. I mean, there's kind of a big twist at the end of episode 2 as far as like who is involved in the crime. But, you know, by this point in any series of Prime Suspect, it would be very clear that the show had more on its mind, right? It would be very clear that it was confronting in a kind of unblinking, you know, clear-eyed way that it was confronting something happening in society. And so it's, you know, given the pedigree of this show, it's disappointing that it doesn't seem to be particularly interested in doing that, right?
Like the original Prime Suspect was so deliberately of its time and place, you know? It was not a series that could have been set just anywhere with any cast in any time period. Like, it was very specifically of its time and place. This show does seem to want to have it both ways, in which, you know, the coding that shows us that it's happening in the early 70s, you know, like, yeah, people are, you know, there's folks with afros and bell bottoms and stuff, but the kind of, you know, apart from the occasional mention of, like, Richard Nixon, you don't see that the larger goings-on of the world have any impact on the micro world that's at play here. And, of course, it does. And it should.
Right. I mean, but it's, yeah, this does feel like a crime, a case that could be lifted out of this show mm-hmm. and placed into basically any kind of detective show. And yes, at the time period, it's so far anyway, it really only serves to allow for certain like fashion choices, to allow them to put like Pink Floyd on the soundtrack and have characters mention the Kinks and the Beatles and whatnot. But like, it doesn't go beyond that. It doesn't go, at least again, in these initial episodes, it doesn't go beyond that in terms of really looking at what's going on in the society at that time. And I think, like, for instance, too, the way that the black officers are used and not used, as we talked about at the start of our discussion, is a clear, you know, seems to be a pretty clear indicator of that. Like, how can they have these guys just sort of as another, you know, one of their like rank and file officers who mm-hmm. just carries out the same kind of sexism that all the other officers do, and not even sort of at least acknowledge that they must, because they're black, have a different experience within
exactly.
those structures.
Exactly. You know what I thought, actually, as I was watching it, I thought, you know what I'm much more interested in is not Jane at the very beginning of her career, mm-hmm. but Jane before we see her in Prime Suspect, in the 80s. So Jane living and working in Thatcher's England in her 30s, right? Mm-hmm. So she's made it past those beginning stages and kind of jumped over those hurdles. But she has not yet achieved the detective inspector rank, right? Like, I want to see her closer to the woman that we now know, particularly yeah. with the coping mechanisms that she has clearly taken on board. So like her drinking, for instance. I mean, mm-hmm. Jane's like drinking problem is a consistent through line throughout the series and just gets worse as the series goes on. I want to learn more about who she is and where she is after that kind of initial. Like, I just wasn't interested in Jane in the 70s, but I would be very interested in Jane in the 80s.
I mean, if they started to show some of those developments, like if we started to see her character change and move in that direction, I could be interested in that. But yeah, to be honest, I based on what I've seen of Tennyson so far, the first two episodes, I'm you know, I'm disappointed. It's not the level of complexity of, you know, cultural honesty that I would have hoped for and expected from, you know, a Prime Suspect show. I mean, mm-hmm. that first season of Prime Suspect with Helen Mirren, I mean, the sexism that she faces in the station on the job is so intense and so vile. And like a big part of that season is just about her weathering that and how that sexism works within the department, and you know, it's like, so far even that aspect of this show of Tennyson so far just feels like a, oh, you know, I roll my eyes at it, like, oh, they wanted to do dishes or whatever, but it's almost like it's just, it's acknowledging it, but it's not, like, exploring it. It's just right. kind of like, this is how it was. And Prime Suspect as a show was so much better about, like, actually exploring these things.
Yeah, you know, I don't see that the raw material we are given in Tennyson will ever be weathered and, you know, sort of under the pressure become the right. flint-hard diamond that is Jane Tennyson. I don't see how that process occurs.
I agree. Okay, so I think that'll be our last word on
I apologize because that was my pick for the week. So anyone who watches it based on anyone who listens to me and what I suggest, you get a little bit of what you deserve. But Carolyn has to do it for work. So I will take the loss on this one.
Well, just, you know, watch Happy Valley, I think, is maybe the takeaway there.
What's your deal? What's your deal?
What's your deal?
What's your deal? What's your deal? What's your deal?
Ebony, what's your deal this week?
Oh, well, Carolyn, as you know, because I texted you about this on Saturday evening, The Bridge Season 4
is now
available for American audiences. I've been talking nonstop about this, and I have basically like a Google alert set up. And I was this close to just bootlegging it somehow. Anyways, it's finally available. It's on Hulu.
Tell the people what The Bridge is for those who may not know what it is.
If you don't know what it is, holy, have I got a gem, a delicious cake for you. The Bridge, at least the version I'm talking about, which was the original Swedish-Danish version, is an absolutely phenomenal crime drama surprise that I have loved from the very first season. It is now in its fourth and final season. The show, from the beginning, has about the inner workings of both the Swedish and Danish police systems and the ways in which two cops, you know, on opposite sides have to sort of come together to solve these, you know, what turned out to be incredibly elaborate Byzantine puzzles. The star of the show is a character named Sega Nguyen, who is coded as and explicitly referenced as someone who is on the autism spectrum. And I think, not being a neuroatypical myself, her, although what we don't have here is someone from that actual community playing that character, so that is problematic. Nevertheless, I do find her portrayal so much denser and more layered and three-dimensional than the ways that we've had characters like this in the past. So yeah, the fourth season is just now available. I've powered through 6 episodes already.
Whew.
In like a day, because I can't stop. Y'all know that I briefly tried to learn Danish because I was watching so much of The Bridge over and over again that I was starting to recognize really horrible words like stab and murder and rape. And I was like, these can't be the only Danish words I know. So now I know words like rice and bear and meat. But this season, we have to come back to this. I guarantee you this is going to be my freak out again. I can't talk about it yet because it was just made available. So I know I would be spoiling it for anyone who's trying to watch it. But I would love to talk to people about the ways this final series completely takes back what we've learned about Sega.
Mm.
Or appears to. But mm-hmm. then, because you know these people have their hands on the wheel, they completely shift you and pull the rug out from under you. And no, it turns out that they know what they're doing. I'm only on episode 6, but oh my God, this show is so fucking good. I don't know what I'm going to do when it's over. I don't know what I'm going to do, Kara.
All right. So I obviously have to get on that.
Get into it.
Yeah. Yeah. So my freak out this week is the video game Donkey Kong Country Tropical Freeze. As many of you probably, it's a really good video game, Ebony. As many of you probably know, it was released originally for the Wii U, I think in 2014, but it just now came to the Switch. Unfortunately, it's priced as a full price, you know, $60 game, which is frustrating for like a 4 or 5 year old game. But I do have to say that that if you haven't played it, you know, the Wii U didn't have the largest sort of player base. If you haven't played it, it's one of the best sort of 2D platformers of all time. It just, on every level, the level design has such a fantastic flow to it. The environments have are so vibrant and charming and just create this wonderfully upbeat and beautiful atmosphere. The music is just so catchy, and it's just an infectiously like upbeat, colorful, joyful experience. Even though it gets quite difficult at times. And the one nice thing about the Switch version is that it does introduce a new mode that kind of lowers the difficulty and makes it more accessible for players who may have kind of bounced off the game's challenge level before. But go ahead, Ebony.
Oh, you know what I love about hearing you talk about video games? Well, I love everything about hearing you talk about video games, but the games you play and your delight in them is such a counterpoint. So, okay. Folks, if you haven't started listening to Cinema Ball yet, you need to get into it. This week we're going to be talking about a film called Louder Than Bombs. And one of the things that happens in this movie, it does this thing that drives me absolutely fucking around the bend, which is that playing video games becomes a narrative shorthand for this person has problems, right? So, like, all you need to do is someone playing video games and you're like, oh, they have problems. But also, it exists in a world in which only these sort of, like, dark, hyper-violent video games exist. I would like to see a movie one time where people are like, yeah, I'm feeling absolute shit in the world, and so I'm going to play some Donkey Kong instead of playing, you know, Elder Scrolls Online or whatever. I don't know. Anyways,
exactly.
I love that when you talk about video games, it's always just like, man, I had such a great, fun time playing this thing. Not like I sat in front of my computer crying into my Mountain Dew.
Absolutely. I definitely think, I have a soft spot for the upbeat, colorful, endearing video games, certainly. So, yeah, that's gonna do it. That's our show this week. You can catch us back here every single Wednesday. Remember that you, too, can join our podcast community and help us bring you this content every single week at d.rip/femfreak. Also, if you're enjoying the show, please leave us a review on iTunes, because it really does help spread the word about our show. And, tell your friends, too. Anita always has like a clever thing to say there, like that ties into whatever the show was about, you know, like tell you like, but I didn't have anything. And now I feel bad that I didn't have anything. Sorry, everyone. But Anita will be back at some point, and she'll have something clever to say there when she tells you to tell your friends about the show.
Mm-hmm.
That's why she's the actual host of the show.
And that's
I'm
right.
I'm just the fill-in host. You can check out all our work and our other podcasts at feministfrequency.com. And also, please be sure to follow us on Twitter at FemFreak to stay up to date on all the things we're doing. Also, hit up Ebony and I on Twitter if you like. You can find me at Carolyn Michelle. And Ebony, where can the good folks find you?
At The Plague.
Mm-hmm. That's it. That's it for sure. Nailed it. Our producer is Phil Circus, who also composed our theme music. We'll see you next week.
Bye, everybody.